Welcome to the Social Network Show. How do you feel about social technology and this connected, networked world we live in? Your host of the Social Network Show, Dr. J, interviews informed and entertaining guests to tackle the most pressing digital issues of interest to business professionals and nonprofit leaders, to parents and educators, and to anyone wondering where all this is taking us. And now, your host, experimental psychologist, Dr. Jane Karwoski.
Today's episode of the Social Network Show is brought to you in part by Pulse Insights. Pulse Insights adds a valuable new dimension to your website analytics through one-question micro-surveys scientifically designed with you to find out what you need to know most about your website visitors. Please go to pulseinsights.com, take a look, and ask for a demo of how they can help you know more about what your visitors think. Welcome to the Social Network Show. I am your host, Jane Karwoski, experimental psychologist, Dr. J. Astute regular listeners may have observed that I am getting more and more intrigued with the related issues of privacy and security. These apply to online and mobile phone technology. Both are thoroughly involved in communicating with your social networks. I am totally excited to be able to introduce you today to the person who will teach us a ton about these issues, Bruce Schneier, author of Data and Goliath, The Hidden Battles to Collect Your Data and Control Your World. Mr. Schneier is a computer security guru, a cryptologist who has the unusual talent of being able to explain it all so that the rest of us can understand. And he writes that way, too, having published 13 books on various aspects of security and privacy. He is the chief technology officer of Resilient Systems, which out of the three goals to prevent, detect, and respond to security breaches, focuses on perfecting the response to incidents and helps companies thrive in the face of today's cyber threats. It was named by the Boston Business Journal as one of Boston's 2015 best places to work. He is a fellow of Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University and a board member of Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, which defends your rights in the digital world. I am so proud to say, welcome to the Social Network Show, Mr. Schneier.
Hey, you make me sound very, very busy.
I imagine you are. So in your book, Data and Goliath, and that makes it easy to know, should I go data or data? Data as in David, Data and Goliath, you called chapter 10 privacy, while chapter 11 is security. To start us off, can you explain the difference between the two?
All right, so you want the theory questions first. You know, they're both very overloaded words. They're used all the time to mean very different things. They can be used interchangeably sometimes. I mean, privacy is certainly more specific. Privacy is your right to control information about yourself, your right to control what people know about you, your ability to keep information about you only known by people to whom you tell. I mean, it's a very complicated set of things involving you and information about you. That's privacy. Security is more broad, right? Security can include privacy. No one feels secure if they're, if everybody knows everything about them, but it also includes safety. It also includes freedom from fear, much more general things than privacy. I mean, they're related. So you might lose data, a bank might lose your credit card information or financial data. That is a breach of security because you might have money stolen from your bank account. It also could be a breach of privacy if it tells people what you've purchased. Right? The Ashley Madison hack that we're hearing about in the news is certainly a breach of privacy, because the names of people who are on this adultery site is being made public. It has security implications as well. So they're related concepts, but it is important to tease them apart if you actually talk about this. But I won't forgive any listener if they just sound muddled.
Okay. Well, with regard to privacy, two tech moguls have made widely quoted declarations. One, Eric Schmidt, CEO of Google, said, "If you have something that you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place." Another, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, claimed that privacy is no longer a social norm. So let's take those one at a time. Do they make sense? And do the proponents live by them personally? What's wrong with the "if you have nothing to hide, you don't need privacy" idea?
Well, I mean, it's what I said to answer your first question. Privacy is not about something to hide. Privacy is about having control of your information. It's about being a whole person. I don't have something to hide when I talk to my friends or talk to my loved ones. But the things I tell them aren't going to be the things I tell you. Not to hide, because it's none of your business, because I get to decide as a fully functioning human being how I present myself to the world. Right? When you are forcibly exposed, you know, like in the Ashley Madison case, you lose control of how you are perceived. When we're reading about this, there are people who are on that site not because they are cheating, but because this is one of the ways they felt they can find the relationships they're looking for. And while it's not wrong, it's none of your business. And you note that the people who say, "if you have nothing to hide," don't actually publish their email, don't actually publish their bank accounts. They say these things, they don't actually live by them. So you know it's not true because they don't behave that way.
Yeah, I understand the Google CEO was concerned over employees sharing personal information about him.
So you're right. And that's because he understands that his privacy is valuable, not because of something to hide, but because he gets to decide how he presents himself to the world. You know these kind of statements aren't true. These are the people who say them don't believe them because they don't live like they believe them.
Similar to someone who is wants to ban all guns, but they are surrounded by armed bodyguards.
Right. It's really easy to say that from a position of power. And the Zuckerberg quote is similar. I mean, he says that privacy isn't a social norm. I forget what he says. He's, of course, wrong. It's absolute nonsense. And he and everybody else on his site cares about privacy. It's a pervasive myth that privacy is dead or the young people don't care about privacy. It's certainly not true. Anytime you talk to young people, they care greatly about privacy. It is a very strong social norm. It's different. The things that are private and the things that are public are changing. But we are all concerned about privacy to some degree. And we will act like it, and we say it whenever we're asked.
Well, it goes beyond a social norm, too, in the sense that I think you explained it very well in the book, that it is a human need or right, because it's something that doesn't vary that much from society to society. You know, a given society will have different norms, but there's always something about what's private and what isn't.
And I think it's a very basic human need. I think it's even older than that. I mean, if privacy is about control, if you are observed in all things, I think you start feeling like prey. You feel powerless. And we know this. We know this from research in prison societies, in other areas where people don't have privacy. They act differently. And I make an even stronger point in the book that privacy is necessary for social progress, that the ability to think new thoughts and to try new things away from the public gaze is how we progress as society. And if everybody is observed, everybody is conformist. And then things don't progress. So it's a very important human value, and one we shouldn't just toss away lightly and say, well, it's no longer a social norm.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go on to the issue of mass surveillance. It's done by corporations. It's done by governments. You call it ubiquitous. Can you give us a sense of how information about us is everywhere and always being collected?
The way to think about about it is that computers collect information. As a natural byproduct of what they do, they collect data about themselves. And what's going on in our world is so much of our lives are mediated by computers, and they become sort of de facto surveillance devices, not out of malice, but of how they work. Right? So I have a cell phone in my pocket. That cell phone knows where I am at all times. Right? It has to, otherwise it can't ring when you call me. It becomes a surveillance device. Now, we're having this interview on Skype. Skype knows that I'm talking to you, is going to know how long we're talking. If it wanted to listen, it could listen to what we're saying, because there's a computer there. Now, I'm going to use the web. There'll be records kept of the sites I search. My email. All of that is recorded, not just who I'm talking to, but what I'm saying. And when you look around at all the computerized devices, the cameras, the point-of-sale terminals recording what we purchase, there's so much information available about us and what we do. And now what's going on, of course, is that data is increasingly being collected because it's just cheap to collect. It's increasingly being stored and used. This is big data. This is the promise of big data. Save everything, and you could figure out what to do with it later. Well, that everything you're saving is surveillance data. And we don't realize it, but we're basically under constant surveillance from the devices we use every day that make our lives enormously convenient because they are actually computers.
That goes toward answering my next question, was how on earth...
I am nothing if not predictive.
How on earth did this happen? How did it sneak up on us? Part of it you've just explained is part and parcel of the way computers work. But in terms of who is collecting it in the sense of looking at it and analyzing it, maybe not looking at it by a human being, but putting it through algorithms, etc. How did that sneak up on us?
Well, it's the technology and then the social piece. The technology was computers producing the data, data storage and processing becoming so cheap that you could save it all, and this idea that we want a personalized marketing, which internet gave us, that gives companies the incentive to look at it and to use it. And then most government surveillance piggybacks on this. I mean, it's not like the NSA woke up one morning and said, I want to spy on everybody. They kind of woke up one morning and said, hey, look, these internet companies are spying on everybody. Let's get ourselves a copy. Mm-hmm. So those were the pressures. The technology made it possible. The idea that we're going to fund the internet through personalized advertising gave the business impetus, and then the government came along afterwards as, hey, look, we can use that too.
Yeah, give me that data. Well, this is fascinating. We're only halfway through. This is your host, Jane Karwoski. You are listening to Bruce Schneier. He will share more thoughts with you from his book, Data and Goliath, The Hidden Battles to Collect Your Data and Control Your World. So we will talk about that in the second half of today's episode of The Social Network Show.
Questions? Comments? Reach out to us. Our email address is questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com or find us on Twitter @SocialNetShow.
You're listening to The Social Network Show. I am your host, Dr. J, and you are listening to computer and internet security expert Bruce Schneier. You wrote recently for your blog, Schneier on Security, about an experiment that an ABC reporter in Australia did by publishing the metadata collected through his mobile phone. Could you tell us what is meant by metadata and why it isn't just harmless impersonal info?
Yeah, metadata is an interesting term. It's been used since the Snowden revelations, and it's been used almost derisively, that something is only metadata, therefore you shouldn't care about it. It's in some ways makes no sense. Here we have the NSA collecting it, and it's really important. On the other hand, it's only metadata, so not really important. Metadata technically is data about data. More in the vernacular, it is data around content. I mean, let me maybe play you an example. This conversation we're having is the data. The metadata is the date, the time, the location, if we're having it on cell phones, who I am, who you are, the billing address, the credit card number, if this is a paid service, all of that is metadata, right? In an email, the stuff I type is the data, the from line, the to line, the date stamp is the metadata, and we can argue about the subject, right? So the metadata is not the conversation content, it's the stuff around the conversation. And the NSA wants this because it's incredibly valuable. It is all surveillance data. I mean, the first question you asked me about, you know, what is all this data being collected? All of that is metadata. Location of our cell phone, what's your browser you're talking to? All of that is metadata. So it's incredibly personal. It's incredibly important. It is all surveillance data. So that's what it is. It's in some ways more important than the conversation content, than the data, because it's easy to store, to search, to correlate. It tells us a lot about relationships, what people are concerned about. I mean, if you call a suicide prevention hotline, I kind of know what you're saying. And mm-hmm. So that's metadata. In some ways, it's a false dichotomy. I think it's a bad word because people tend to think, oh, it's only metadata, when that really is the opposite way to think.
Well, it seems that is a excuse, you might say, or a smokescreen put up by those who are collecting it to make us think that, oh, it's not, don't worry about it, it's not personal, we can't learn anything about you from it. But actually,
if that was the case, they wouldn't collect it, right? They wouldn't collect it. I mean, in some ways, they're proving themselves wrong by wanting it so badly. But yes, that is what they say.
Right. And the reporter found out that, and he, it was, I'm sure it was no surprise, but just the average reader of the piece could deduce quite a bit about him, just derived from this supposedly impersonal information.
But think about your cell phone. It knows where you sleep, where you work, where you go. It knows when you go to sleep, when you wake up in the morning, because you check it. Right on either end, if you and your partner have one, it knows who you sleep with. It's a surprisingly intimate device just from the metadata.
So now how much of that is unavoidable? I mean, it, obviously you say a lot of it has to happen for it to work properly, for your calls to come in. But where along the line should we object to this surveillance society, and what can we do to rein it in? So first of all, where do we draw the line as to what we're okay with if we want to maintain some kind of privacy?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question because, I mean, you're right that a lot of this metadata has to be collected for the system to work. The question is, how is it stored? Who has access to it? I mean, we're actually okay with telling Google where we are because real-time traffic information on Google Maps is just fantastic. And that service is based on surveillance. Right? Google knows everybody who's using that system, how fast they're going, compared to how fast they could go, and then computes where traffic jams are. It's a great service powered by surveillance. But that data for that service is only useful over the next 2 minutes, and then it's obsolete. So the real questions to ask about these are less about the data collection and more about their storage and use. Who has access to it, under what circumstances, and for what purposes? And we can object to, I'm going to make this up, Google saving it for 5-10 years, handing it to the FBI. We could object to China using it to find out what political protests are and arresting people, while not objecting to getting real-time traffic information. So it really are the subtle questions about how the data is used.
And it comes down to the ethics, law, regulation questions, which
yes.
Last week I spoke with Gary Marchant, who has from Arizona State University, and we talked about the possible alternatives to the very slow, cumbersome legislative process. But it's one thing he brought up was liability insurance can put requirements, an insurer can require their insuree to live up to certain standards if they're going to get a certain right or get insured at all. But one thing about using courts is the terms of service on so many providers, the apps and so on. They are ridiculously long. No reasonable person can read the terms of service of each of the things they use. What do you see in terms, is there any hope for not allowing those to indemnify providers?
Yeah, I don't know the answer. The question you're asking is above my pay grade. This is a general question about click-through agreements, whether it makes sense to bind people legally to something you know they haven't read and you know they don't understand. That makes no sense. On the other hand, you really can't negotiate a contract every time you want to go to a website. So it's hard to know what the answer is here. I agree with you that the current answer isn't really satisfying.
Do you think that bringing suit against companies that misuse data or allow leaks or hacks would be is bringing about change?
I think it is, because what it does is it raises the cost of having bad security. I mean, our privacy is violated because our data is stored by all these companies, right? Google has our email, Flickr has our photos, Ashley Madison has our wish list for infidelity. You know, all of this data is controlled by these third parties. And unless they are liable for mishandling it, they can have no incentive to keep it private. So I think both lawsuits and regulations are valuable in increasing the cost of insecurity, thereby incenting security.
And that, of course, is one thing Resilient Systems, the company you work with, has a lot to do with, right? Helping companies focus on the best response once an incident occurs. So do you think that the idea that Jaron Lanier, author of Who Owns the Future and You Are Not a Gadget, has proposed a micropayment system whereby netizens are paid for their data collected, in addition, I presume, to getting the services for free. Do you think that suggestion has potential?
I don't, for a couple of reasons. One is your data is actually not worth very much. It's surprising. We hear all about this data-driven economy, but your data is worth like $10. It's barely worth setting up the system to give you the $10. Also, any kind of micropayment where when my data is accessed, I get a little money, that is an enormous surveillance regime. You think
right.
about it. To make that work, I have to keep records of who's doing what to the infinitesimal degree. And I'm not sure that cure is better than the disease we're trying to fix. You know, I actually think we're much better off with a rights regime than a property regime. When we view our data as property, it comes with it certain things, right? You can buy property. I mean, we sort of know what to do with property. When you think of it as a right, it comes with a sort of a different set of baggage. And I think it's a better one. So it's more like, you know, your free speech. It's more like, oh, I don't know, your kidney. You can't sell your kidney. We know you might want it, but you're not allowed to, because we know that the social ramifications of that will be abhorrent. Right? You're not allowed to sell yourself into slavery. So thinking about privacy in terms of rights than properties, I think is going to yield much more fruitful results. So then that's sort of the meta answer to your question.
Okay. So if the data is really worth $5 to $10, I don't know if you're talking about annually, if whether it's monthly or annually, wouldn't people, it doesn't sound like very much to pay for privacy to my way of thinking.
It isn't. It isn't. And the problem is that companies aren't offering it. I mean, Facebook could offer a privacy-enhanced version of itself for a $10 annual subscription and make more money. Like, they don't do that because they want this economy of your data, right? And they want it not to be something you're thinking about. So there isn't this market because big data promises eventual big returns. And I think it's an overpromise. And I think when we finally realize that, you'll start seeing these more privacy-enhanced services. But right now, you're right. You know, you can't buy a cell phone that doesn't track you. You can't find a social network that doesn't track you. You can use DuckDuckGo instead of Google. DuckDuckGo doesn't track you, but it's still really minor because Google's bigger and better.
Right. And the same problem arises when people say, well, just stay off of the internet. You know, it's totally not practical.
There's lots of advice like that. It's really easy to say, you know, don't have a cell phone, don't have a credit card, don't have an email address. But it is really stupid. I mean, you can't live a fully fledged existence in the modern world without those tools. So opting out is only for, you know, the extreme person who's living in a cave.
Well, the other thing, too, is that just in the last 12 to 18 months, it seems to me that I have noticed more and more move to connect us all into it. Now, I know Mark Zuckerberg views his project as this tremendous thing of making the whole earth one organism and we're all cells in the organism, which is creepy. But to, for instance, the Republican debate, the first one, was hand in hand with Facebook. Oh, you can, you know, making Facebook sound like it is the commons. It's the way that citizens debate, et cetera, et cetera. When really, and more things say, oh, sign in through Facebook or Twitter, for that matter. What do you think is going on there? Is it an enhanced economic advantage?
I mean, it's certainly an advantage to being pervasive. I think there's something very dangerous about having the public sphere fall into private hands.
Yeah.
That these platforms that we believe sort of intuitively are commons, are neutral, are public, are in fact for-profit entities. And that if we behave in a way that Facebook doesn't like, whether it's, you know, showing a photograph of breastfeeding or saying something politically that they might not approve of, we are kicked off, which, you know, doesn't happen in a public sphere. And if it does, we have legal recourse. We don't in Facebook. Facebook gets to decide.
Right. And it says it is or is not in harmony with their community standards. And when you see what is on there, you wonder what the community standards could possibly be. But, well, those are fascinating and intriguing thoughts. And I thank you so much for taking time to join us.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's truly appreciated. You've been listening to the thoughts of Bruce Schneier. And my thanks also to you, our listener and most important guest, for keeping us company on the Social Network Show. I'm looking forward to hearing from you through an email to questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. Please do visit our website at thesocialnetworkshow.com, and you'll also find us on iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Audioboom, Stitcher.com, and check out your app store for the Social Network Show app. Please have fun and be safe online and off till we talk again.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the worldwide show dedicated to social media networking and understanding the connected, networked world we live in. Listen to our archive shows on thesocialnetworkshow.com and follow us on Twitter @SocialNetShow. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia Incorporated. The views and opinions expressed are those of our host and guest and may not be the views and opinions of Social Network Intermedia.